Abdel Basat al-Megrahi, the sole convicted Lockerbie bomber. The Scottish government has been dealing with sharp criticism from the U.S. government and families of the victims since Megrahi was returned to Libya, where he received a hero's welcome. Al-Megrahi was convicted in the 1988 killing of 270 passengers aboard a Pan Am flight that crashed in Lockerbie, Scotland. FBI Director Robert Mueller says al-Megrahi's release gives comfort to terrorists. Some Scottish lawmakers are calling for the judge in the case to resign. Al-Megrahi was released last week because he has terminal prostate cancer. Scottish officials concluded the most humane position was to allow him to return to Libya to die. Several Shiite groups in Iraq announced today that they are forming an alliance as they plan for the parliamentary elections in January. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count is a state-by-state look at child well-being and the important role of data at aecf.org.
Now, here's something you don't hear every day.
I was born with a mustache.
But you will hear that, and the story that goes with it, on The Best of Public Radio. I'm Robert Siegel. Join NPR's Ari Shapiro and me as we revisit some funny moments from your favorite public radio programs. It's also your chance to help us make great radio in the months ahead.
Saturday from 5 to 8 p.m.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, whose 26th season explores literary and musical themes from opera to Broadway, featuring works from Beethoven to Cole Porter, and opens with a musical homage to William Shakespeare. More information is available at 333-6280.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with writer Tamim Ansari, and we will talk about his most recent book. The title is Destiny Disrupted, the subtitle A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. It's published by Public Affairs Books. He says for much of history, the West and what is now the core of the Islamic world were like two separate universes, each living out a different story, each believing that it was at the center of human history. His book, Destiny Disrupted, tries to look at the history of the world through Islamic eyes, and it tries to explain how it is that these two great civilizations managed to grow up next to one another and yet so ignorant of one another, and also looks at what happens when these two civilizations intersected. The book has been out for a while now, has been getting good response, and if you'd like to read it, you head down to the bookstore or to the library. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. Tamim Ansari grew up in Kabul in Afghanistan. In the 60s, he got a scholarship to an American high school and indeed came here, went to Colorado Rocky Mountain School, after he moved to America. After that, he graduated with honors from Reed College. He is regular columnist for Microsoft's learning site Encarta.com. He has written nonfiction books for children, a literary memoir, and this is probably the thing that he'll be best known for, that is West of Kabul, East of New York. He's also written several novels. He now makes his home in San Francisco, where he's director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop. Tamim Ansari, hello. Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, hi. Good to be here.
Well, I really appreciate you giving us some of your time. There is a story that you tell at the beginning of the book that I think is very revealing. And this is this story that you tell about being hired to develop a new world history textbook for high school students.
Yes, uh-huh.
And the fact that as you were putting it together, you decided that you really thought more attention should be given to Islam. The problem you had with the advisors you were working with was that, no, they didn't think that it was all that important.
In textbook publishing, you have a large core of people working together, and the idea of that is to ensure that what the textbook presents is something like the consensus of the society about what's true, which is actually a very good thing. It was just interesting to me that as we were trying to decide how much weight to give to various events in history, periods in history, and just how to, divide all of time into 10 units, each divided into three chapters, you know, in that schema, my advisors seemed to feel that Islam and the Islamic world was not a central topic. So that's what sort of got me started on the whole project that led to this book.
And this was in 2000, so obviously when we get to 2001, 9/11, 2001, things changed. Or at least at that point, we have more people saying we really ought to know more about the Islamic world. We don't know as much as we should.
Well, I think there's been more attention now and more things written about the Islamic world and about parts of the Islamic world than I ever saw before. You know, I come from Afghanistan, and in the 2 years after 9/11, I feel like everybody I know learned so much more about just the intricate little details of Afghan life, whereas before they barely knew that it was even in Asia.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, there is a European worldview, at least if you talk about the European view of history. It is one that, as the Islamic world does, begins in what we now call the Middle East, but very quickly shifts to the Greco-Roman world and then on through the history of the rest of Europe. And there no doubt is a certain kind of a worldview embedded in this that maybe we don't think very much about because it is so much a part of the way that we think that it's difficult to step back from it.
Well, yeah, you know, when we study history here in the United States and most of the world, when we think of world history, we go from Mesopotamia to Greece to Rome, and then we have the Dark Ages, and then, you know, civilization revives again, and we have the Renaissance and the Reformation, and on through to the Industrial Age. There is another line you can follow from Mesopotamia instead of going to Greece. A big imperial civilization existed and then flourished east of Mesopotamia, you know, in Persia, Afghanistan, northern India, Central Asia, that area. And it had a continuity going on through history. And that continuity, you know, a chapter in that, an important chapter in that, was the birth of Islam. So if you go, instead of going to Greece, you go from Mesopotamia to Persia and then to the Islamic Empire and then on into not the Dark Ages, because the Dark Ages coincides with the Golden Age of the Islamic world. And then you see that interrupted by the Mongol Holocaust, and then the Renaissance and revival is not so much what happens in Italy. It's what happens in the Ottoman Empire, the Safavid Empire, the Mughal Empire. And so there you have this parallel other sort of set of events and a narrative. And then something happens. You know, then the West has developed and flourished, sort of ignored and unnoticed by the Muslim world. And it arrives in all the different parts of the Muslim world as traders, consultants, entrepreneurs. And before Muslims know it, or rather, you know, over the course of a couple of centuries, Muslims wake up to find, hey, their world is permeated by the West and they're not masters in their own house anymore.
Mm. Well, that certainly invites the question, how is it that these two parts of the world managed to develop these significant cultures and economic systems and ties and literally exist right next to one another and yet know so little about each other?
Well, my thought on this is that there is a point of departure here in early history. And the point of departure is that the Mediterranean Sea itself was a sort of an organizing principle for what I call a world history. I don't quite know what other word to use for it, because what I mean is that there were many, many societies near the Mediterranean that, because of the ease of travel on the Mediterranean, knew of each other and were involved in one another's fates. And you find that east of all of this, in ancient times, there was also very busy trade and travel routes of people who were moving by land, you know. And so those routes went from the shores of various seas to one another. They went from the Caspian, you know, to the Indus River, to the Persian Gulf, to the Red Sea, to the Mediterranean. And there was a network of land travel routes that organized a world over there. So I think, you know, when you have more to do with one another than with outsiders, you tend to build up a sort of an internal world narrative. And that's what happened with the Mediterranean world, and that's what happened with the what I call the middle world, which is that world that lies between the Mediterranean world and the Chinese world.
Mm-hmm. So what I suppose we now would say would call the Middle East and West Asia.
Yeah. You know, I would say that one of the curious facts is that we don't, in ordinary discourse, we don't have a single word to refer to that whole area. And I would say that, you know, growing up in Afghanistan, you're aware of civilizational things that happened in India, in the Turkish regions north of Afghanistan, in Iran, and Mesopotamia is part of that world too, you know, because it's Iraq. There is a coherence to that world. There's there is a sense in which that is a world, not just a little piece of it being the Middle East and then another piece of it being, I don't know, India or whatever. You know, it's a world in the same sense as the European world, and let's remember that when the European world is not aware of the other, it is not necessarily harmonious. You know, it's like Germany, France, Great Britain. They had some mighty conflicts in the course of time.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Tamim Ansari, and we are talking about some of the things that you will find in his most recent book. The title is Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. That's the subtitle. It's published by Public Affairs. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here to talk with in Champaign. It's line one. Hello.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I found it interesting that you use the expression Mongol Holocaust, referring to the Mongol invasions of the Islamic empires. But I'd like to sort of take it a little further back and talk about Islamic Holocaust to Central Asia, in the sense that the Islamic invasions destroyed the Buddhist nations and societies in Central Asia and in especially in the Indian subcontinent and including Afghanistan, where you're from, and that not only was it a political invasion, but it was also a cultural invasion, in the sense that they not only chose to have political power, but also destroyed Buddhist monasteries. They had pogroms against Buddhists and Hindus, destroyed Buddhist universities throughout what we now call Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and further on. So in one sense, if you focus, depending upon which perspective you look at from the Islamic point of view, this is a flourishing. From the Buddhist and Hindu point of view, which were the indigenous population and indigenous cultures, this is an invasion, a suppression, a destruction, pogroms, genocide, etc. And I'd like to sort of take it a step further and ask you to also talk about the difference between political Islam and spiritual Islam. Spiritual Islam being the religious tradition which says, you know, all people serve God, etc., and political Islam, which differentiates between those who are Islamic and those who aren't, and imposes Islamic values, forced conversions, second-class citizenship, etc., on those who aren't Islamic. And then take it one step further and expand that to how that is playing out now in both Islamic world, in terms of inter-Islamic conflicts, and
yeah,
in terms of
the United States. You know, you're getting so far away from the original stuff that the things I was
right
thinking to say about that, I'm going to forget by the time you get to the end
okay
here. So I'm just going to break in here. One thing I would say is that, you know, no single perspective is the true perspective. I completely agree with that. So what I'm doing in giving the Islamic perspective of world history is not to say, oh, that's the right one, these other ones are wrong. We're in the process, I hope, of compiling a master narrative that includes all the different perspectives. We'll never get there. But part of the task is to look at the story from different centers. Now, what was that thing? Oh, you know, you keep mentioning the Buddhists. Actually, Buddhism was not in Afghanistan by the time the Muslims came. Those were the Kushans, and they had been overwhelmed by other tribal sort of things that happened. Most of that was the Zoroastrian world. The depredations of India that were carried out by Muslims happened somewhat later, actually. It was when the Turks invaded the Muslim world from the north, then converted to Islam, and then became zealous, champions of the faith and went down into India and sacked all those cities. The political Islam and the spiritual Islam, I hope people read my book, because that's a complicated issue, and my book, I think, centrally tries to lay that out. And what I want to try to get across is that the core of the religious Muslim experience is the birth of that community in Medina. So there was something about Islam from the beginning that intertwined the political project and the spiritual project. And that has been, I would say, problematic throughout the history of Islam. However, when Islam first expanded, it didn't expand, it didn't go and overwhelm other societies and stop them from doing what they were doing and convert them to Islam by the sword. Famously, it purported to set up structures in which each community was allowed to live under its own laws and pursue its own religious practices, and that was characteristic of the Khalifat that was centered in Iraq, and it was characteristic of that other Khalifat that was centered in Andalusian Spain. Yes, it's true that Muslims had an air of superiority within the world in which the Jewish community was also accorded its rights, and the Christian community was accorded its rights. It's true that the Muslims felt that they had the right thing, and eventually these other communities would see the light and become Muslims. But initially, that was a system of tolerance such as did not exist in other parts of the world. So, history evolved.
I want to thank the caller. I'll have somebody else here. I'm sure we can come back to some of the other questions, particularly things as they stand now.
Yeah.
The relationship between the West and Islam. Let's go on to another caller here. This is Urbana, and it's line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I would like to agree with your use of the term Holocaust. When Genghis Khan first entered Iran, Persia, and took the city of Mashhad, over three-quarters of the population were exterminated. And his policy was to turn the eastern portion of Iran into a steppe. In fact, that was his plan for the whole of the world. He wanted grazing land for his horses.
That was said to be the case. Mm-hmm.
The Turkish administrator, his treasurer, later talked him out of it, that it was evident that live citizens were more valuable than grassland. But this wasn't typical of the Arab invasions. There were no, to the best of my knowledge, in the early Arabic period, mass exterminations of populations. It was typical of the Mongol Turk, Tamerlane, Timur, in particular, was bloody.
Yeah. I didn't hear a question there, so all I can do is say, yep, you're right.
I do have a question after agreeing with you. Why was it with the very vigorous and vital trade along the north shore of the Mediterranean between Christian states and the Arab traders that there doesn't seem to have been an intellectual interaction. Were the Europeans just not ready for it?
Well, there wasn't that vigorous a trade. I'm not sure what you mean by the vigorous trade between the Christians and the Muslims. According to some historians, the advent of the Muslims into North Africa cut off long-distance trade for the Christian societies of the Germanic territories, and that was what actually was responsible for the Dark Ages. But you're right that there was not much curiosity on the part of the Muslims about Christian civilization in Europe. When Muslims thought of Christians, they thought of the Christians that were there in the Middle East amongst them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And since very shortly after the advent of Islam, the material level of civilization in the Muslim world as compared to Christian Europe was so different and so much more advanced in the Muslim world, they just thought of the lands west of Byzantium as being, the land of the barbarians. Nothing of much interest there. And when the Crusades happened and the Crusaders came, the Crusaders were very interested in all that they saw in the East, but the Muslims, from all the record that we can find, they just experienced the Crusaders as a terrible catastrophe that came out of the forest, and they didn't have any interest in, well, what do they think? You know, what is their ideology, and what kind of life do they live back home? There was no curiosity about that. They didn't see it as a clash of civilizations or as a challenge to their way of thinking. And that's what happened. That's what did happen, however, later when Europeans colonized the Muslim world. Muslims were forced to say, wow, what kind of idea do these guys have? So that was a real difference in that later period.
But that was after 1600.
After 1600, yeah.
There was trade, though, along the south shore of the north shore of the Mediterranean, at a rather later date, after, say, around 1200.
But the trade was still much more vigorous within the Muslim world and within the trading network that extended all the way to India and into India. I would say that that's where the movements of goods was most vigorous. And that's why until sea travel became, the dominant way of getting around the world, these places that were far inland, like Samarkand, in Central Asia, places Bukhara, Samarkand, these were like these legendary wealthy cities, and because they were right on the nexus of trade routes, once sea travel became the mode of the day, every place that was near a coast became urban and sophisticated, and places that were far inland and within the Central Asian mass became remote, sort of forgotten backwaters, and there was a whole sort of turning of the center of gravity of civilization at that point.
I want to again thank the caller. We're already at our midpoint here, and for people who are listening, I'd like to introduce once again our guest, Tamim Ansari. He grew up in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, went to high school and college in the United States. He's the author of the memoir West of Kabul, East of New York. He's been a major contributing writer for several secondary high school history textbooks. He now makes his home in San Francisco, where he's director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop. He also writes a column for Encarta.com and is the author of the recently published book, Destiny Disrupted. The subtitle is A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, and it is published by the Public Affairs Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think that part of the story that perhaps interests me most is the story of the early history of Islam, of the establishing of the faith by the Prophet, and then about this period right afterwards where there was a big struggle about who it was that would lead the community and then what direction it would go in.
Yeah. You know, that was a dramatic, roughly 30-year story. And it was the story of people grappling to see what the implications of this tremendous event was. You know, and the tremendous event was that Prophet Muhammad received his revelations, and then he founded a community. And that community was you know, to be the stencil of the human community ultimately. And as soon as Prophet Muhammad died, his successors, or the people that were, you know, the people he left behind, said, "What kind of a community do we have? The stencil of all of mankind, and you know, the exemplar of God's will on earth, if we no longer have a prophet?" And the prophet had stated explicitly, "After me, there are none others." So there was not going to be any revelations from God at that point, from then on. And now, how do you operate? You know, how do you carry forward this project of this community that has sacred purpose and intent, if all you have is, you know, the revelations you've received? Mm. And the split on that is what led to, you know, these two different streams of Islam, the Shias and the Sunnis, where the Shias said, there will be somebody, he won't be a prophet, but he'll be somebody who has some special dispensation from God to make right decisions, and there's always going to be one of those. And the other school of thought said, nope, you know, the Quran and whatever the example of the prophet's life was, that's it. You know, that's what we have. And we have to derive all other instructions from studying those as carefully as we can and parsing out all the implications. Mm. And, you know, ultimately the Shias also study those ancient texts and parse out all the implications. I think, you know, in a sense, that idea won out in Islam. And it's had a huge effect on Islam as an entity in the world, because it made Islam a very text-based, scholar-ruled, and legislative sort of a religion, something that persists to this day. Mm-hmm.
Something that really strikes me, and you tell me if I'm kind of getting this right. You know, I think that now people in the West, in Europe and the United States,
yeah,
tend to think of Islam as some kind of alien philosophy. And what really strikes me was that what Muhammad was proposing, or what he was doing, that he didn't really think that he was inventing something new.
Not at all. He felt he was in the Abrahamic tradition. Even now, you know, Muslims will say Islam didn't start with Muhammad, it started with Adam, you know. Uh-huh. And, you know, they would say Abraham is a Muslim prophet, and Moses and David, and also Jesus Christ. You know, he's mentioned often in the Quran, and they claim him. Muhammad saw himself as a renewer of the message that had been there all along. It was well within the Judaic tradition. Mm. In fact, you know, there was a Pakistani writer who wrote something I thought was interesting, in which he said, until a couple of centuries ago, it would have made more sense to speak of Judeo-Muslim culture than Judeo-Christian culture. You know,
Yeah, the other one, I have some other callers here. One other thing that, again, strikes me, and particularly then if you look at this period of time when Muhammad and his followers are establishing the community in Medina,
yeah,
this idea that what they were saying was that anybody who wanted to come join them could, this was kind of an intentional community in a sense, and that might have something to say about how it is that Muslims identify what they identify with the strong idea of the community of believers. And that's not to say that there isn't nationalism involved. There is. But that the point of identification seems to be different and seems to have been different at the beginning than Christianity, or at least than what Christianity has become.
Well, you know, Christianity from the very beginning was a proposal for individual salvation. That was the spirit of it, and that's the core sort of mythological. I don't mean to say that in a dismissive sense, but the core event of Christianity was the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and the core analogous event in Muslim history was the birth of this community and the fact that it was successful. So that's a very different kind of a launch point. You said intentional community, and I think that's exactly right. You know, the community that Muhammad started, it was an idea of how to live on earth, and one of the specific things that he talked about is we're not going to be tribal anymore. You know, we're not going to have our lives dominated by our allegiance to our tribes, but our allegiance to a set of ethical and moral values that apply to all tribes. And you know, there is something about the proposition of democracy as vested in the Constitution that is analogous to that. Our declaration in the United States is that we are under the rule of the law, and we have a procedure that will enable people of all different, whatever their tribes are, to live together and contribute to the same project, because we operate by a set of principles that apply to everybody. Mm-hmm. And, it's a different set of principles, but it still has that same kind of universalist quality to it.
Let's talk with some of the callers here. We'll go next to a caller in Champaign County. This is line one.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was originally going to call about what I learned from this show about Edward Martell and that class of civilizations. And if my takeaway is correct, it was that it really wasn't a big fight. It was more that there was a schism in between Syria and then Iraq, or now Iraq, that called people back. So there wasn't really the fight was not really engaged now.
Which fight are you talking about?
Well, this is the big battle in the what century would that be? Dave, do you remember 700 something? It was characterized as the
Are you talking about in Europe?
Yeah, and this is in Spain, I guess. The battle that
Charles Martel or the
I got that.
The Muslims.
Right, the takeaway that I had on the and actually this was just all what I was going to ask you to comment on how it looked contemporaneously if you research that, but I'm now more interested in, and I don't know if you'll get back to that or not. I'm now more interested in asking you about your assertion that Islam did not predominantly spread by the sword, because now we have the Bishop of Rome in Regensburg a couple of years ago now talking about quoting somebody from some centuries ago characterizing Islam that way, and my understanding of that was, well, that was true, but it's casting the mote out of someone else's eye rather than your own, that the church actually spread by the sword to a great extent around, particularly Latin America is a great example of that, though other places as well. So it wasn't that, you know,
Well, you know, the thing is, I think we have a natural tendency, or there's a tendency to separate, especially when we're in the Western context, we think of spirituality as being one thing, and politics as being something completely different. And so the proposition of the religious life is, okay, the world is corrupt, but you don't have to be. You can be pure yourself, you do the right things and you follow these rituals. But within the political realm, there are often movements that say the world doesn't have to be this way or that way. We can fix it. We have a better system. You know, communism was an example of a proposition to heal the ills of the social world. And so we just think that religion is one thing and politics is something completely different. And the ambiguity with Islam is that it was both a religion and a political event simultaneously. And it did, Islamic rule did spread by warfare in the same way that Rome did, in the same way that any political entity in history has extended its power by sending out its armies. So Islam did that. But when it took over a place, then there was that second part, which is, does everybody have to become Muslim? And that's the part where Muslims said no. The characteristic of our idea of how to run a world is to only set up Muslims as the example to everybody else. We're so right that they will all come over once they see how, you know, how well our community works. But other communities can go on and live as they want. The way in which that idea of tolerance doesn't match our idea of tolerance here in the United States is that it didn't exactly contain an idea of individual rights. It assumed that everybody belonged to some community of faith, and that it ceded to each community of faith its authority over its members. And I would say that now, yeah.
A critic might say, well, that there were economic and other cultural pressures for conversion that shouldn't be dismissed. I'm not sure how you would.
Well, yeah, there was in this sense. If you were not a Muslim in those Muslim empires, you had to pay a tax. You had to pay the not being Muslim tax. On the other hand, if you were a Muslim, you had to pay the charity tax. So there were two taxes, and I think the economic consideration was probably, I'm not sure how important it was actually, because you could have access to important positions in government without being a Muslim. Quite often in those Muslim empires, the wazir, the chief administrator of the realm, might be a Christian or a Jew, and architects and whatever people who had some skill, they would be hired. Didn't matter if they were a Christian or a Jew, or a Zoroastrian. But I think that there is a natural tendency to want to convert to the dominant, to be part of the dominant group in society. You can call that an economic motive.
Well, that's more a cultural pressure, actually. But
You're more likely to be successful if you're part of a dominant group. So I think there is a glamour associated with that.
Okay. Well, I guess I don't know if you want to pursue Martel. My joke to myself was that, well, maybe there was someone fomenting covertly a schism back in the motherland of Islam to destabilize them so that they actually did have to withdraw back, and that it wasn't Martel on the battlefield, but it was more.
Oh, I don't know about that. You're saying there was a schism amongst the Muslims and that's why Martel won? I don't know about that. You might be right, so I just don't have any information about that.
Right. And we have just about 10 minutes left. I have another caller. I want to introduce again our guest for anyone who has just joined us, Tamim Ansari. He's the author of the memoir West of Kabul, East of New York. He is a major contributing writer to several secondary high school history books. He writes a monthly column for Encarta.com. He's published essays and commentary in San Francisco Chronicle, in Salon, Alternet, a lot of other places. And he is the director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop, and he makes his home in San Francisco, and is the author of the recently published book Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, published by Public Affairs. We have another caller here I want to get to, and they are in Champaign, and this is line two. Hello.
Yes, hello. I think that your projects there of educating people about Islam is very good and contributes to maybe more peace in the world. I couldn't believe the things that people would say after 9/11, just ridiculous things about the Islamic world. And so as you've gone been doing this project, I just wonder if you encountered obstructions. And also, I find that through different media like film, I'm learning about the Middle East. And I was just wondering if you could comment on, like, The Kite Runner, which is about Afghanistan, and right, really getting an idea of what's going on there in Kabul from that.
Well, you know, The Kite Runner is a brilliant novel. I really, really liked it. It was partly written in my San Francisco Writers' Workshop, so, you know, I have an attachment to it that's more than just reading the book. Yeah, it does give a portrait of what's going on in Afghanistan. I would only say it's not the only, you know, it's like I think Kite Runner has sometimes been seen as, okay, we know all about Afghanistan now, we read The Kite Runner. There's a lot more to Afghanistan than the Kite Runner, and there's other writers up and coming, and I hope that we will make room for more Afghan-American literature. I'm working on that project.
Anything that you would say to the caller's first question? We did actually earlier talk about your efforts at writing a world history high school book and wanting to put more about Islam and the Islamic world in there, and the other people that you were working with, or perhaps were working for, said, well, no, we really don't think that's all that important. In continuing to try to talk about this, do you find people generally interested?
I do find people interested, and I find that, you know, I feel like my project is worthwhile because I find that people who are very sympathetic are still in a position where they're translating from their own experience over to what must be the Muslim experience, and the translation doesn't quite work because you really have to start. You know, it's a question of a whole framework. So you have to kind of be inside the framework and see that there is no one-to-one analogy between the different parts of these two kinds of worldviews. And that's why I wrote a history, because I feel like you go all the way back and you come up and you see, you understand certain things. What was the other part of that question? Did I miss some?
Well, no, I guess it was about how people... and react to what it is you're trying to do, at least what you're trying to encourage them to do, and whether people are open to that or not.
They are, but, you know, I go around and speak about this stuff, and I encounter, you know, a certain amount of hostility at every place. Not at every place, but at some places. I think some of the questions are sort of hostile. Mm. I think there's, you know, we live in a world in which there is tension and turmoil. So there's hostility on all sides. You know, it's like Muslims also don't understand certain things about America, I would guess. Although, you know, I think America is more well known in the rest of the world than the rest of the world is known in America, and that's natural. America is so dominant. You know, everybody knows what it is and what happens here. So,
well, let me ask you about something else that I think has certainly been a factor shaping the relationship between this part of the world, the middle world, and the European world, particularly has shaped that relationship after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and that is colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it didn't start after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. The fall of the Ottoman Empire was all intertwined with colonialism, and, you know, the weakness of that empire had a lot to do with the permeation of Western commercial sort of interests eroding the viability of the Ottoman Empire. So it goes back a couple of hundred years before World War One. It was World War One when the Ottoman Empire finally completely collapsed. And a lot of the trouble that we have in the world today is the unresolved fragments of the Ottoman Empire, you know, still trying to find their way. Israel and Palestine is a dramatic example of that. That was part of the settlement of Ottoman territory by the British during and after the collapse of that empire. Kashmir is another example. You know, that's not the Ottoman Empire, but that's still colonialism and the British attempt to pull out and leave some semblance of order behind them and failing.
what, just as a way of finishing up, maybe we have about 5-6 minutes left.
Yeah.
Whether you think that it will be possible, and I think your argument is that what we need to do as a project is to see if we can take our various stories, our individual stories and our national stories and the way that we look at the world, and manage somehow to weave them into one, so that we're not talking about your story and my story, we're talking about our story.
I think so. And, you know, I think that we are being woven into one by underlying material factors in any case. So it's going to happen. You know, all those things I said about sea travel and land travel, now that's completely moot, because you can be in, you know, some remote village in Afghanistan and still have access to the Internet, you know, and write to your friend in San Francisco. So the weaving together of the world is happening, and the weaving together of the narratives is necessary, and it lags behind. And so that's what I'm hoping we're involved in now.
Mm-hmm. Something that I think it's still difficult for people in the West to understand, and perhaps it's because we have this dedication to this principle, at least in principle, of a separation of church and state. The thing that people, I think, have a difficult time with is in this world that you're talking about, the interconnections, the tight tangling together of religious values and religious beliefs and political ones, and the ways in which religious beliefs inform society.
It's important to remember, though, that since we are like 3 centuries on into the intertwining of the Western world and the Muslim world, there is a really substantial part of the Muslim world that comes out of a tradition that has been built up there of secular modernism. There is that strain in the Muslim world, and it is in discourse, debate, and argument with other strains in the Muslim world. And the outcome of those discussions is going to affect us, but there's to some extent we can't affect those discussions. You know, it's going on in Iran and has been going on in Iran throughout the period of the Islamic Republic. That revolution there was not just an Islamic revolution. It was an Islamic revolution. It was also the culmination of the constitutional democratic movement in Islam that then was aced out and overwhelmed by the Islamic element of the revolution. And the other parts of that revolution are still there in Iran and are still trying to make their voice heard. It's important for us not to look at the Islamic world and just see, you know, Sharia and Ayatollah laws, but also to see that some of the parts of the Muslim world that we can be in conversation with are not necessarily just moderate Muslims in the sense of being a little less Muslim. You know, there is a secular idea of Islam that has been developed and is being developed in Islam by Muslims who don't think they're any less Muslim than the next guy. You know, so we need to be aware of that complexity and diversity of the Muslim world.
Well, and that seems, I think that is important, that it seems that we are preoccupied with those elements within Islam that tend to be more traditionalist or anti-modern or whatever you want to call them, and maybe with good reason that we are preoccupied with them. It seems that we haven't, though, I think our level of awareness of just how complex this conversation is really lacking.
Yeah, and we have to be able to differentiate issues that come out of colonialism that are sort of material issues or are issues of, you know, access to resources and this sort of thing, to differentiate that from doctrinal sort of arguments between the secular humanism of the West and the Wahhabi fundamentalism of jihadist groups in the East. You know, there are things going on, for example, in Pakistan, you know, that have to do with actual material injustices that people are trying to work out. And then these doctrinal things are mapped on top of that. You know, so the more we know about it, the more we can parse out the distinctions between all the little forces that are at play there.
Mm-hmm. Just for a moment to end with, I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the title of the book, and I guess I am assuming that this reflects a perspective from this world that looks back to the Golden Age and where it is they are now, and asks what happened. How did somehow things got knocked off the tracks here, and we're not really quite sure how.
Right. Well, you know, I wanted a title that would give that would capture as best possible the simplest single arc of the story I'm telling, and the one feature of this story is that it had a momentum towards a destination. Historically, and then at a certain point when it interacted with the West, it found that it was no longer moving towards that destination, and so a big a problem, or just, you know, a source of many issues in the Muslim world, is what to do now that it doesn't look like history is moving the way it was when there was only an Islamic world. That's the story in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that there were important things that you learned, even though you were someone who had grown up as a part of this world?
It would be hard to just name any single big thing. There were a million little things that were just fascinating that I learned as I did the research that would enable me to fill out the picture I was painting.
Mm-hmm.
Just little things about, why it was that the situation of women declined in Islamic societies, why it was that Islam had this head start on science and then didn't pursue it, and you know, what happened to science in the Muslim world. Just looking at the Western world, how the Reformation was connected with the rise of power in the Western world. I could go on and on. The way in which the Crusades was an intimate part of the explorations that led to the discovery of America and the colonization of India.
Mm-hmm.
So the connections are just awesome.
Well, we'll have to leave it there with the recommendation that people look at the book, Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, by our guest Tamim Ansari. He is also the author of the memoir West of Kabul, East of New York. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and many local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to WILL, that's will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
It's a minute and a half before noon. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, I'll invite your telephone calls for journalist Melinda Blau. We'll talk with her about the book she co-authored, Consequential Strangers, The Power of People Who Don't Seem to Matter But Really Do. We'll talk with Melinda Blau this afternoon, beginning at 1:06 Central Time. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, September wheat is trading at $5.15. That's up 6¾. December, $5.16½, up 6¾. In Chicago, September wheat 468 1/4, up 8. December 495 3/4, up 8.5. September corn 326 1/4, up 4.5. December 331 3/4, up 5.5. March 345 1/4, up 5 3/4. May 354 1/2, up 5.5. September soybeans 1067 3/4, up 44 3/4. November 999 1/2, up 26 1/2. January 1002 1/4, up 26 1/2. March $10.75. That is up 26. September meal 343.50, up 10.50. September oil 37.07, up 74. At the Merck, August live.